And now, live from Jerusalem, you're listening to Israel Inspired Radio. Here are your hosts, Rabbis Ari Abramowitz and Jeremy Gimpel.
Shalom and welcome to Israel Inspired on the Land of Israel Network. That's thelandofisrael.com. Ari Abramowitz here with my best friend in the world, Jeremy Gimpel, live. You know, when I say that, best friend in the world, it does sound like a little bit like...
Childish. A little bit childish.
But the truth is that, like, are we not?
What are we going
to
do?
Are we not childish? We just, like, had a trip up to Tel Aviv to determine about the Knesset and the future of Israel, and we were literally acting like eight-year-olds, bickering the whole way. So it's a little childish, but you know what? That's a good thing. It's important to never take yourself all that seriously, not to lose that inner child, because what happens when you lose the inner child?
You start to die.
Well, I guess so, yeah. You get jaded. You stop believing in miracles, and miracles are commonplace here in Israel. You're back from vacation.
I don't know if I can call it a vacation.
Not vacation, right?
My family was with me, but it was hardly a vacation.
It was hardly
a
vacation.
At the end, there was a little bit of vacation time, but that was actually the worst part of the trip. But the whole other part of the trip...
Why was that the worst part of the trip? Guys like us don't know how to vacate.
I don't know how to just... I don't know how to do the vacation thing. But give me a mission that I'm on. You know, this amazing family from Virginia donated their RV to our family. And it wasn't just an RV. It was like a full bus that was, you know, it's like a home on wheels that you could happily live there with three or four kids easily for the rest of your life. You could make that your home easily. And so we traveled. We started off in New York, made it down to Virginia, went all the way down to South Carolina, cut across America to Texas, looped back to Oklahoma. It was an incredible experience. I spoke almost every night, if not every other night. And during the day, we would do kid, you know, fun family activities. We'd go fishing. We'd go hiking. But the
for some reason, when I pictured you doing this, just driving your family in a house, driving the house down across the America, I just thought to myself, that guy is brave. Like, how much can go, so much can go wrong. Did things go wrong?
You know, there was so much room for chaos for kids. My kids sometimes behave like chickens. If you put them in a small closed area, they'll start pecking at each other. But my kids knew that we were on a mission. They behaved beyond well. We met so many people. Immediately, all my kids were playing with their kids.
When you say they knew you were on a mission, what do
they
you mean? What mission did you imbue them with? What
we were there to represent Israel and the Jewish people to the Jews of America and the righteous nations of America, to be a Kiddush Hashem, to be a sanctification of God's name, to show what a family based on the Torah is like, what siblings of a family based. They knew that they were walking on representing the Torah in the world, the Jewish people in the
world,
Israel in the world.
You know, it's a gift you're giving them that I remember having growing up that Israeli Jews don't get. There's a certain gift of being an exiled Jew that's observant, that wears a kippah, because when I went around with that kippah on, I was representing more than myself.
Right.
You know, and you're able to give them a taste of what it means to represent more than just themselves, because in Israel you don't have that same sort of energy or responsibility, because it's just a bunch of Jews.
You know, the first event that I had was in the heart of Manhattan. It was like at the very bottom of Central Park. You know how Central Park is like a rectangle? So imagine in the very bottom of Central Park, in the middle of the bottom, first row, 35th floor, I don't know what, the most amazing apartment view. It was as if it was out of a movie. And we had just landed that day or yesterday, I don't remember. And I brought my two oldest kids to my first event because we were in Manhattan that day. And so we go up to this amazing apartment. All of these Jews come walking in. There's a few non-Jews there, but mostly Manhattan Jews that were there. And my boy Akiva said, "Abba, what are all these Jews doing here? It's so weird." And I started off my talk saying that to them. I said, "I want you to know, when my boys first got here, the first question my son asked me was, what are all these Jews doing here
in
New York?"
Can I just interject for a second? When I went to the grocery store yesterday to buy your kids Doritos, I had that same thought when I was going through the grocery store and I was looking around and everyone was Jewish. I'm like, what are all these Jews doing here? That's so crazy that everybody in the grocery store is Jewish.
Yeah, it's really.
I still have those thoughts because growing up, if I saw a Jew in the grocery store, I was like, oh, you're a Jew. No, everybody's Jewish. It's too much.
So you should know that, like, I spoke. That was my first event was in Manhattan, and the event was awesome. I really made some wonderful connections there. Really, I delivered just Baruch Hashem, a divinely inspired speech to these Jews. You know, because what happens to the Jewish community in America is that their purpose, if they're going to be connected to Israel, bottom line is, if they're not going to live here, they better give a lot of money to Israel. And so a lot of their connection to Israel comes through fundraisers. And then if you're fundraising, what do you got to do? Either you got to scare the Jews that Iran is building a bomb, so give money to AIPAC. Guilt them, scare them, make them feel like Israel is in poverty and they need money. So almost all of their Israel events, I never really understood, it like either makes them scared of Israel or somehow like feel bad about Israel. And I come in and my message is totally Israel inspired. I'm not here to raise any money from them. I'm just here to connect them to God and connect them to Israel.
You weren't there to raise any money.
I didn't raise a shekel from those Jews in Manhattan. Okay. I didn't make an
it
ask for those Jews in Manhattan.
It better have been worth it.
Maybe
we could use that.
Well, my goal there was totally not to fundraise, at least in my mind. Who knows what
might come of it? No, you did the right thing.
Totally. And so I was there.
You remember when I went to China and I came back when I was working for the government, right?
Right.
And I was like, it was incredible. It was historic. It was biblical. And he was like, yeah. How much money did you raise? I was like, I forgot to ask for money.
Oh, we're supposed to raise money in these events?
Yeah, right.
So I walked there. It was such an awesome event. But the truth is, I would literally die for these Jews in New York. They're wonderful Jews. I love them. I love the Jewish people. But the thing that was truly like blew my family away were the righteous of the nations that we met throughout this trip. I spent most of my time talking to them, and my family got to meet their families. They got to meet my wife. It was like such an encounter. The friendships that were born and the friendships that we had that we just didn't have enough time together. Now I finally got time to like spend with some of these people. And some of these people, as soon as I met them, it was as if we knew each other for years because they listened to our shows. They're connected to us. It's like they knew us. I remember 4 weeks ago where you spoke about this and this and this and this. And I'm like, oh my gosh.
Yeah, it's actually a thing when you're talking to me like, you know, it's like this room is filled with Japanese. Yeah, I know that.
Yeah,
that's episode 4A. Yeah, I'm like, oh, God.
And so the connections and friendships that I felt were like rekindled and built the community. It's like a global community that's being connected through this network was so awesome. The soul connection that I felt with these people that are not Jewish, that are living in like a biblical rhythm, that are living by the Torah to the best of their ability.
It's funny. The only thing we can really say at this point is these people that are not Jewish.
Not Jewish.
Because what else?
What are they?
What are
no
they?
One knows what they are.
And to me,
they don't know what they are.
That spiritual no man's land where you don't fit in any box, that to me is almost definitionally a holy, holy,
holy
place.
Holy place. I just love these people. The soul connection that I felt with them was more powerful than the soul connection of a lot of just the secular Jews that I spoke with in Manhattan. Like, yeah, how could it not be? The secular Jews in Manhattan, they love Israel and they're, you know, they're for Trump and they're one of that whole world. But when they're not like connected to the Torah, they're not connected to God, it's, you know, there's a deeper connection that I felt with these people. And it's like a movement of historic proportions. And the truth is the Jews don't know what to do with it yet. The Jews don't even know about it yet. When the Jews finally get taste of what's actually happening all around the world, it's going to blow their minds. We're going to have to figure out, what do we call these people? Who are they religiously? Who are they spiritually? What is their identity? Can they move to Israel? Are they moving to Israel? The irony was, I spoke to some Jews in Manhattan that had more money than some states in America. The states in America are in debt. These people have like a ton of money and they don't want to move to Israel. They could buy 15 houses in Israel and it wouldn't bother them. All of some of these non-Jews want to do is they want to move to Israel, but they can't because the government, because of money, because of whatever the reasons, but they are dying. It's like such an interesting way that things are being orchestrated.
By the way,
right,
I want to just bookmark. I want to talk about that on the next program. Talk about what it is, how non-Jews interact here. Why can't they be citizens? Why shouldn't they be? What their residence should be, if they should be allowed? These are questions that need to be
asked. That's a really good idea for our next show. I want to tell you just this one story that if I had to say, like, what did I experience on this last trip aside from the friendships and the amazing times that we had? It was my new friend, Rusty. Rusty is a...
Is this where his name has changed to protect the innocent?
No, his name is actually Rusty.
Okay.
And that's important because that's not a very Jewish name. That's like about as, you know, Midwestern Texan as you can get. It's... He's a tractor...
What would his Hebrew name be? Chaludi?
I don't know. That's a good question.
Right? Rust is Chaluda?
So, I don't know. That's a good question. So...
no, it's not.
So, I'm meeting Rusty for the first time. And Rusty, I believe it works on tractors or on trucks or a truck driver, something like that. I don't remember, but I mean, I broke a part of the RV and he came on Sunday morning or sunrise to come and fix it. The sweetest, most giving, most wonderful person, Rusty, walks into this house that I'm staying in. He's got a giant cowboy hat, cowboy boots, a big belt buckle, the whole Western twang. Hey, I'm Rusty. It's nice to meet you. I look at this man. He's got a long beard. He looks like Lynyrd Skynyrd rock band country singer. I don't know what to put. He looks about as far from a Yid from Manhattan or from Israel as I could imagine. He is an official truck driver from Texas named Rusty. And then Rusty sits down and he takes out his zit, takes off his cowboy hat, and then there's a kippah on his head. He puts on reading glasses and opens up a chumash, and we start learning the parsha together. And then before my eyes, Rusty the truck driver transforms into what may be a rabbinic sage from Jerusalem before my eyes. And I said,
can I just tell you, it reminds me in my head, it's like these Rav Shlomo stories of like Laser Wolf, where the 36 righteous people, and then the rabbi says, that's one of them. And he's like this old, decrepit. And within that is like such righteousness. Not that
and
he's
holiness.
Old and decrepit, God forbid, but I mean, just the transformation.
No, I just looked at Rusty,
like.
And I'm looking at Rusty, I'm like, this, there could be nothing farther from a Jew. He just doesn't look like a Jew. He doesn't sound like a Jew. He doesn't look like a Jew. His name is Rusty. His name is not Baruch. It's something that's like totally Gentile. And in before my eyes, it was like a transformer. And then he looks like a rabbi from Jerusalem. That is what is happening spiritually to these people all around the world. Because I've seen them in Norway. I've seen them in Germany now, in Holland, all across North America. And it's like the world doesn't really know. No one's controlling them. No one owns them. No one's really directing them. They're literally being directed by the Torah and by God.
Yeah, I have this feeling all the time because, when we talk about what we're doing, we're not infrequently attacked by Jews who say, oh, this guy Rusty and all these people, they just want to impersonate Jews so then they can convert us to Christ. And now all of a sudden, they're the expert, insider, omniscient knowledge of the motivations of everybody else and what it's about. But in my mind, in my heart, it's like when I meet these people, the purity of their quest and their thirst for knowledge and for connection is so inspiring. I don't need any confirmation from anybody. I mean, sure, there are people with duplicitous, impure motives, but most of the people I meet that are on these
are real people.
Are real
human
people
beings.
That are so thirsty and so holy. And I know because when I leave, I feel closer to God. They feel closer to God. And something beautiful happened there. And it sounds like, from what you're saying with Rusty, no, this.
Yeah, I mean,
how did that play out? How did your family receive that?
I wonder if my kids have a skewed perspective now of what it means to be not Jewish, because all the non-Jews that my children know now are all Torah observant Gentiles, and it's like that can't be. But that's not true because we spent time in the big city of Manhattan. They saw what secular society is. They saw the tattoos. They saw the homeless people. They saw the people ignoring the homeless people. My kids hated Manhattan. I thought the kids were really going to love Manhattan. They were going to see the skyscrapers, the flashing signs, the movie, the sign.
I think
colors.
Anyone that really loves Manhattan, there's something that needs to be
investigated. Hated yeah. Manhattan. There were so many homeless people, and I remember like. LaVie was saying, is this an evil city? Look at all these homeless people and everyone is ignoring them. No one's paying any attention to all of these homeless people. It's just an evil city.
Just invisible
just like
people.
Invisible people. And my kids have never seen homeless people like that. They don't really have homeless people like that in Israel. There's too many shelters. There's just too many places for them to be. And they were like loud homeless people. I don't know what's happened to Manhattan. In the last 10 years, it's really become unbearable. But so they've seen the real and they've seen the not. I think what really struck me was that so many people around the world are praying for us. And I don't just mean us. I mean us. People are actually praying for Ari Abramowitz and Jeremy Gimpel and our families. But they're also praying just for the Jewish people. So many people are praying for the Jewish people. And I was thinking how beautiful that is. And that's definitely something that I lack a lot in my prayers. I spend a lot of time praising God. I spend a lot of time singing to God. I spend a lot of time thanking God a lot. I mean, I feel like sometimes if I really just take accounting of my blessings, I can't ask for anything ever again. I'm just so blessed. I just want to thank God for everything. But to pray for others is such a holy idea. And Tehila brought this to my attention. And she said, imagine this mashal, imagine this analogy. We're in the RV and our kids, sometimes they're behaving great, sometimes they're bickering, sometimes they're fighting, sometimes they're this, sometimes they're that. But the greatest moment of like a parent's life is when a child comes up to you and says, you know, my little brother here or my big brother there, it would really be good, Abba and Ima, if you could give them X, Y, and Z. They really want it and it would really be nice for them. That, like what that does to a parent when the child would actually ask for the other child, instead of it being a sibling rivalry, it would be like care, concern, and praying for. Our Father in Heaven, when I think about these non-Jews finally praying for the Jewish people, not trying to convert us.
That's why for generations, for all of Jewish eternity, it was Ephraim and Manasseh is the example that the father blesses his sons with. Because it was the first time that there wasn't sibling rivalry. Ephraim and Manasseh, and Ephraim was younger. And no, he pushed him and he encouraged him. And that was the example of like what we should be as a Jew.
Here, there's also a beautiful passage. It's one of the most famous verses in the Hebrew Bible. But it's, Hinei matov umanaim shevet achim gam yachad. You know how good and how pleasant it is when brothers dwell together, sit together. And then it says, Keshemen hatov ala rosh yored ala zakan shel Aaron. And it says, it's like the oil that runs down the beard of Aaron. And I'm like, what does that have to do with brethren dwelling together and how good that is? What is that even about? And then if you take a step back, and this is once again a Tehillah Torah, she said, who was the man pouring the oil on Aaron's head? It was Moshe, his brother. And Moshe, who was the leader of the Jewish people, who deserved all of the credit, who was like the one that sacrificed and raised. At that point, when he poured the oil on Aaron's head and anointed him as a Kohen, and Aaron's children would be the Kohanim, the priests after him, Moses' children, you don't really hear much about them anymore. And at that moment, the love between Aaron and Moshe, you can just see the moment how Moshe is so happy and thrilled being guided by God to anoint his brother. That moment right there where we're giving and blessing our brother, that is like the ultimate. Hinei matov umanaim shevet achim gam yachad. And now on an international level, the nations are davening for their brother. It's like the sibling rivalry is finally over. How beautiful that is. And so just the trip was overwhelming, incredible, beautiful. I'm only now getting over the jet lag. It's like the first normal day that I've had after about 6 days being home. And so Baruch Hashem, it's been crazy.
There's a certain beauty I see that also happens as far as learning from each other. Because it would be really disingenuous for me and also insecure for me to say, oh, we're the teachers and they're the students. Because I really used to be coming from there with a vengeance. Like, we are the teachers, they're the students. But the truth is that I have learned a lot. And I have come closer to God and been inspired. And I think the learning is not so much through verbiage and didactic teaching, but more just a clash of perspectives where they're coming sometimes with a more fresh, raw, like biblical perspective, whereas our biblical perspective, which we gave them through their, you know, because they believe in the Torah, which we gave them, they are now able to return to us because we've lost a lot of authentic Jewish perspectives throughout 2,000 years of the exile. And now, so there's a symbiotic relationship that's going on. But, you know, one thing I wanted to discuss with you is there's a few issues with the non-Jewish love for Israel that I find curious and is worth investigating, worth going into, because sometimes I feel like they love us too much. Like they hold us on too high a pedestal that we're almost like angels to them or something, which is not a bad thing.
Which also just means that they don't know enough Jews yet. And they, as soon as they get to know us, they're going to realize that we're just people like everyone else.
That we're people. Yeah,
and we make mistakes.
But on the other hand, this overwhelming love, it does serve a function and a purpose that's good because Jews have gone through so many thousands of years of persecution hate.
I would even say this. If you are going to love a people, we're a worthy people to love.
I think we're a relatively lovable
people. I think we're adorable people. We are lovable.
When seen through a very specific prism,
just
we're lovable.
Take a snapshot at the Middle East and look which people you want to love the most.
Okay, that's true. We're lovable people because really also what makes one qualified, I think, to be lovable? Well, just the fact they exist is one thing, but more so when they're loving others. And if you look at Israel and the world, is there any nation that aspires to more universalism, more brotherhood of mankind than the Jews? That's the root of the reason many Jews are quote-unquote self-hating Jews. because they feel like it is their Judaism and their nationalism and tribalism and their lack of universalism that is preventing the world from you. So they're the one, first ones to sacrifice it and to put it on the chopping block. And so it's good for some Jews to experience this love from the non-Jewish world and be like, wow, if they love us so much, maybe there is something worth loving, because the cliched Jewish self-hate sometimes feels more like the rule than the exception, especially in the exile.
Sure.
So many Jews you meet, there's like a self-hate there that's become almost just part of the culture of being anti-Israel. And it's so irrational to do, because it's being anti-Israel for Jews is so contrary to the Jewish values, because Israel is a representation of so many Jewish values of liberty and of freedom and of equality, and they're going to be anti-Israel. It's really crazy, but it's important, because think about Jabotinsky, right? He went around Europe trying to tell Jews before the Holocaust, leave, come back to Israel. You said to me yesterday that there's no... that he's the number one named after streets.
Yeah, there are more streets named after Jabotinsky than any other historic figure in Israel.
So he talked about the majesty.
But that needs to be just clarified just 1 minute. People should know that streets in Israel aren't just called Peachtree Street or Creek Rock Road. Like, American names for streets are kind of bland and boring. The streets in Israel, for the most part, are named after either historic figures or historic events. And right. So like, it's like while you're walking through the streets of Israel, you're literally walking through Jewish history.
Right. And the sages of Israel, think about Rabbi Nachman's stories. Most of them are a metaphor to the children of the king. And that's us, and our father is the king, and we're the children of the king. And that's how all of our sages are always comparing it. And Jabotinsky said, even if he become a slave, a Jew is still a prince. The Jew, even in poverty, is a prince. If slave or wanderer, you were created the son of a king, adorned with David's crown. And one of my favorite quotes is from Benjamin Disraeli in the British Parliament, when someone came, stood up and said something anti-Semitic to him. He said, yes, I am a Jew. And when the ancestors of the right honorable gentleman were brutal savages in an unknown island, mine were priests in the Temple of Solomon. So there is majesty to be a Jew, but this overwhelming love, I feel like, what is a subject I'd like to discuss? Because there are non-Jews I meet where it's like there's no disagreement other on like nuances of whether the Messiah is the Son of God or just the Messiah. That's like a big contention. But I love focusing in on the differences and the nuances, because when it's already established that we respect each other and we love each other and we're dear friends, then it's the differences which are the most exciting, at least for me. Does that mean that I'm a Jew? Does that mean I love debate too much? Or do you feel that way too, that you get sort of excited when you're getting into a disagreement with...
I don't know if it's disagreement. I just love the deep conversations that probably have never happened before in world history. Never before have Jews and non-Jews felt comfortable enough to sit down and really delve into the reality of God, the reality of the Torah, the reality of the Bible. What do all these things mean for Jews? What does it mean for non-Jews to actually have deep, meaningful conversation? A ton of times it's going to come into a debate, many times, but it's not just the debate. The whole encounter is so thrilling because it's never happened before.
Right. And that gets to the question I wanted to discuss, because when I was in a certain country, I met a group of evangelicals, and they treated me really like royal first-class treatment. And I felt it was because I was a Jew. They were like treasuring me because I'm a Jew. Which, by the way, when you look at this week's Torah portion, Hashem says to us that we're an Am Segula, right? This is chapter 14, verse 2. Ki Am Kadosh Atah L'Hashem Elokech. You are a Kadosh people, a Kadosh nation, like a sanctified nation. L'Hashem Elokech. Uvecha Bachar Hashem, and Hashem chose you, Liot Lo La'am Segula, to be for him a nation of Segula. Very difficult to translate. I think it's like a treasured, beloved, precious. Treasured, beloved, precious. It's somewhere in that world of adjectives, right?
Yeah, treasured, love, and precious, but there's some sort of spiritual element to Segula, that it's treasured and precious because of some spiritual reality that's imbued in it.
Right. So on the one hand, they could point to that and say, look, you are like a very special, inherently spiritually elevated people. And it's not difficult for me to believe that, because on some level, you look at different nations and different peoples, and everyone has their own strengths and their own gifts and their own functions. And having a spiritual gift does not make you in any way, God forbid, superior. Everybody has a soul, and everybody's got bleeds red, and we're all human beings, but it just means that you have a certain function or purpose, a task.
And there's probably also a bell curve. Like, there's some Germans, for example, are very methodical, very organized, but there are probably also some very disorganized Germans.
Of course,
but as a rule, Germans are very like that. So Jews,
but there's,
I think,
a spiritual predisposition
and there's also,
for the nation on a macro level.
Right, and it's
That's a bell curve.
And so, like, there's a lot of chafifa where there'll be so many holier, right, Gentiles than Jews, but there's like a reality that there's like a Jewish characteristic that we are merciful. It's like, that's what the Torah says, Rachmanim b'nei Rachmanim. And if you look at the Jewish people at large, we're just like a merciful people. We'll just like put up with terrorism where any other nation, if Mexico started shooting rockets onto Texas, that would be the end of Mexico. But somehow Israel will delude itself just to not have to get into violence.
Right. It's
true. Like a merciful people.
Right. So we have all these inherent spiritual qualities, and God himself says we're an Am Segula, treasured, precious people. So non-Jews would be able to point to that and say, well, that's why we treat you that way. But on the other hand, in chapter 9 of Devarim, just last week's Torah portion, it says in the English, Al tomar bilvavchem, and when the Lord your God has thrust them from your land, do not say to yourselves, the Lord has enabled us to possess this land because of our virtues. It is rather because of the wickedness of those nations that Hashem is dispossessing them before you. It is not because of your virtues and your rectitude that you'll be able to possess this country, but it is because of their wickedness that Hashem is dispossessing the nations before you. And in order to fulfill the oath that Hashem made to your forefathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And he goes on, okay? Know then that this is not for any virtue of yours. He's just making it clear, in case we're getting it, letting it go to our heads, that the Lord your God is giving you this land to possess, for you're a stiff-necked people. Remember, never forget how you provoked Hashem to anger in the wilderness. From the day you left the land in Egypt until you reached this place, you've continued to be defiant. Okay, so talk about, like, on the one hand, we're an Am Segula, this treasured, precious people, and on the other hand, it goes on, by the way. Like, we're a defiant, stiff-necked people. It's like can't live with him, can't live without him. It sounds like that's what Hashem thinks about us in some ways. So that's an interesting issue to discuss, but what I found interesting was I was in this country, and I was being treated and loved on by these evangelicals. There were converts who I met that Shabbat that said that the very people that, you know, they used to love these Jews so much with these evangelicals, and then they came to a place where they realized they wanted to be Jews and they felt like they were Jews in their soul. And I'm always naturally, by the way, when I go to synagogues around the world, like magnetically attracted to converts, because they're the ones that are the most zealous. They're the ones that are the most excited and the most passionate and the most alive, and like we're on the same wavelength there. But the question that I have I don't really have the answer to, but I think our non-Jewish friends out there that feel this way, it's worth doing some soul searching, just because I think it's interesting to understand why, on the one hand, I would be loved for being a Jew, but someone who converts from their own congregation to becoming a Jew would not be loved at all, or definitely not in the same way. Whereas in my eyes, they're a Jew no less than I am. I mean, how many, 36 times in the Torah it says that we should be sensitive and love and treat the converts. Unklus, one of the greatest commentators of Torah Judaism, was a convert. Like Abraham was a convert.
Yeah.
To me, it gets down to this thing of like, we're not any more angelic. It's not. We're people, and it has to do with accepting Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob.
Yeah.
You know, even in the Torah portion, let's see, it says here in chapter 29, it says, "V'lo itchem levadchem anochi koret et habrit hazot ve'et ha'el hazot." I make this covenant with its sanctions, not with you alone, but both with those who are standing here this day and those who are not standing here. What does that mean? I mean, Rashi says this is talking about the converts, because they're not there yet. They're not apart. But when it says, when our sages say, Hager Shemit Gayer, a convert who converts, it doesn't say a non-Jew who converts. It says a convert who converts, meaning that God does things that we don't understand. And we as Jews believe that if someone actually goes to the lengths to convert to Judaism, despite being pushed away, dissuaded, we dissuade every religion in the world. Nothing comes close to the level of dissuasion that we give potential converts. Just look at Ruth and Naomi. She pushed away Ruth three times, and Ruth had it relatively easy compared to what a lot of converts go through today. So we push them away, and we push them away, but if they fight and they want it so badly, we believe that their soul was a Jewish soul the whole time to begin with. Do you understand what I'm saying? It's worth thinking about.
Yeah, it's really an interesting idea. The truth is, I don't really speak to evangelical Christians almost ever anymore. I mean, sometimes I'll be invited to speak to groups that consider themselves evangelical Christians, but then the conversation becomes a totally different reality. It's something like very fundamental. It's very basic about replacement theology and what that means for the Christian world. And I think that's a really interesting conversation.
And you know what another interesting conversation is, by the way? Because I like focusing on these things, and it's not there's room for us to grow also. But a lot of times it comes to the veracity of the oral Torah, the Mishnah, the Gemara, whether they believe that that's actually true. Because the accepting that the oral Torah is true brings in an entire world of meaning that I believe goes down to the very core of the God-human relationship.
Sure.
Right? The oral Torah means that we are part of the creative process with God. He has literally imbued us with the ability to create spiritual realities in the world. We're partners in that. But in this week's Torah portion, it says, the verse says, you may slaughter from your cattle and your flocks that Hashem has given you as I commanded you. But there's no such mitzvah anywhere else in the Torah. So where is that as I've commanded you? Where is that commanded? So Rashi says, this teaches us that there were already commandments regarding slaughtering of animals that were given orally to Moses at Mount Sinai. Now, the catch-22 is that people will only agree with what Rashi said if they agree in the veracity of the oral Torah.
No, not really. That's just total logic there. Meaning, if you had to write down how to slaughter an animal.
And he said, I've commanded you. What is that?
No, but just about what would that look like? Okay, grab the animal by here, slaughter. That's something you actually need to orally and visually show someone. You do it with the knife here, you slaughter it at this place, you hold the animal like this, the bracha is like this, you put your hands on it like that. To describe that in words would first of all take up half a Torah scroll, and it would also be incoherent and unclear. That's something that you could only show orally. It's only something you could show visually. You can't show that with black letters on a white page.
Right, but beyond that, just the simplicity of as I commanded you. And it was nowhere to be seen. Even when it says Vasula Totafot Beinechem, you should put signs on your forehead and on your arm. Now, two Jews, three opinions. There's like, go into any Beit Midrash yeshiva in America and Israel. The walls are stacked, packed with Sfarim, with books, filled with commentary and with perspectives and with Torah law. There's so much. And when it comes to the laws of tefillin, phylacteries, there are thousands of laws that go into phylacteries. But there's only two different types of phylacteries that differ based on the order of the parchments in the head part of the phylactery. One says 1, 2, 3, 4, and one says 1, 2, 4, 3, and that's the different order. But everybody else is the same in agreement on all of these laws when all God said was a very general, you should put signs on your head and on your arm. Where did all these thousands of laws come from that they all agree on? It's clearly the veracity of the oral Torah.
Do you want to hear something really wild?
Yeah.
What I heard, and this really needs to be confirmed, but I believe that I heard it from a reliable source, is that in the Bar Kokhba excavations, they found that Bar Kokhba is like, you know, that we're talking about way before the Talmud was codified and written and all of the laws and the arguments of Rashi and Tosfot about the tefillin 1, 2, 3, 4 or the other order were found. But they found tefillin based, of course, on all of the laws of the oral Torah, and one had 1, 2, 3, 4, and one had the mixed, meaning there were two kinds of tefillin in Bar Kokhba's tefillin. And there were just two ways of doing it.
Goodness.
Isn't that interesting?
I never heard that.
Yeah. Well, that really needs to be confirmed, but that's what I heard, and I think I heard it from a reliable source. But I'll tell you the one thing that I've learned the most from this group of people that come from the Christian world. I don't know what else to call them. Almost all of them come from Christianity. And it's like a whole spectrum from that reality. And the truth is, even evangelical Christians, Pashut that way, have this quality and this gift. And it's something that I admire. And it's something that I try to integrate into my life. But that they live with a consciousness of truly listening for Hashem in their life. And you look at these last 2 weeks' Torah portions, to me, they're like a pair. You know, Vaya Ekev Tishmeun, that you should listen. And if you listen, then this and this happens. And this week's portion is, and you should see what this and this would do. Re'e Anochi Noten Lifnechem Hayom. So to listen and to see. And so, you know, Avraham, I was just thinking about this 2 nights ago, held these two incredibly powerful contradictory ideas in his mind and heart simultaneously. At one hand, he understood that the stars of the sky were as many as the sands of the sea. And he's recording this down as God's promised him, God's communication to him. But even in Abraham's time, when there were no lights, when there was no this, there's just not nearly as many stars as there are sand in the ocean. There's just not. You can see them. There's a lot of stars. It doesn't even come close to sand in the ocean. But now that we've discovered that the universe is so far beyond what our physical eye can see, that it's like billions and billions of light years, and even just to comprehend what a light year is, moving at the speed of light for an entire year, and it's billions of those, they've now actually discovered that indeed the stars are in fact as many as the sands in the sea. That's so remarkable in its own right, the beauty of the Torah. But to hold that, on one hand, the vast infinity of God that Abraham obviously understood, that he understood that God is just so far beyond. But at the same time, that he's so close to us in our most intimate places, that he communicates us and guides us through our innermost reality, through our intuition, through our thoughts, that he's so close, that he's like inside us. To hold those two principles together is the essence of being an Abrahamic follower and the fundamental principle, I believe, of Judaism. The fundamental principle of the Bible is that there is nevuah, that God communicates to us. And if nevuah has been taken away to some degree, we still have intuitions. We can still be guided by God. And that our entire avoda, the entire purpose of the Torah, is to guide us to the ability to tune into that voice that Hashem should speak to us in our own life. In fact, what is the most fundamental, essential verse in the Torah that we say in the morning, in the evening, before we die?
Shema.
Shema. Listen. Why doesn't it say De'u Israel, Hashem Elokeinu, Re'u Israel, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad? It's like, no. Guys, listen. Shema. Listen. Hashem is really here. And then if you listen the next to the verses, it's like incredible. It's V'ahavta et Hashem Elokecha b'chol levavcha v'chol nafshecha v'chol me'odecha. You should love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, and all your might. V'hayu ha'dvarim ha'ele. And these things, v'hayu ha'dvarim ha'ele asher nochim etzavcha yom, which I command you today, v'hayu ha'dvarim ha'ele al levavecha. They're going to be on your heart. They're inside you. You can actually listen and feel an intuition and live by that guided reality. And then what is the final sentence? Echad. See, the travesty, the destruction of the Greek world in the Western world that tried to understand the Torah. And they brought this idea that God spoke to us. And it was as if it was a booming loud voice from Sinai. That it was some sort of external reality that we would hear. Avram didn't hear an external reality. It was an inner voice that sometimes speaks so clearly that it's articulate messages. That are, if it's an articulate message, then it's actually in words. But you have to be listening to it to understand it. It's not, the Zohar says explicitly that the Torah spoke not from a voice outside, but from each person's own individual voice. That the Sinai experience, each person heard in their own intuition, in their own voice, and that the whole purpose of Judaism is to actually Shema, is to listen and to realize that it's Echad, that there's not an external voice outside of us that's speaking to us. It's literally Echad, that it's all one. Our internal voice is the way that HaKadosh Baruch Hu communicates to us. And the goal of life is to know which communications are just nonsensical imagery, which communications are just like loud voices that are constantly running and, you know, stupid ideas, bad ideas. I get stupid ideas all the time. And which ideas are actually true, divinely inspired, guided by God, intuitions. And I think that's the key of Re'e Anochi and Ekev Tishmeun, that we should actually see the spice carts in our life, that we should see our lives guided by God through events and even through our own intuition. And the non-Jews, because they don't have halacha, because a lot of times I know I'm doing God's will, I'm following the Torah. The Torah is God's will, I'm following God's will, done, I'm doing that. Because they don't have the Torah. They didn't have the Torah for so long. All they had was
been trying able to cultivate.
To cultivate it, to fine-tune it, to really hone in. And I think that the times ahead of us...
And by the way, that's the only way I can really understand when I travel around America, especially, but around the world, and I meet these isolated, disconnected communities of people that are on the same trip. That is such a out-of-the-box trip of connecting to the Torah in as authentic a way as they can on their own journey. It has to be that they've got their ear really fine-tuned to a certain intuition that, by the way, I've really been working hard on developing myself, that intuition of it takes listening. It takes to be able to stop. First, you pray and pray and pray and say, God, let me know. And then I find that when you have an idea of how to proceed in this dilemma and that brings you a serenity inside, there's a good chance that's from Hashem.
Yeah, I was just thinking last night, I was just playing my guitar and singing to Hashem. And you know, all of these different thoughts, when you're just singing, like, you know, your mind just can sometimes wander to the most weird places, like just like daydreaming off into who knows where. And I was thinking that what is Jewish meditation? What is it really? What is the goal of Jewish meditation? We talk about Jewish prayer a lot, but what is Abrahamic biblical meditation? Ultimately, it's to be aware of your thoughts. And, you know, a very famous meditation that was made famous first by Rabbi Nachman, then Arya Kaplan wrote about it in his book of Jewish meditation. Rabbi David Zeller taught a lot about it. To just sit and say the words, Master of the Universe, Ribono Shel Olam. Now, when you say that over and over again, what happens? Different thoughts come in and out of your mind. But as long as you're continuously bringing it back to Master of the Universe, then sometimes some thoughts will just be like random daydreaming. But what is biblical meditation? What is Abrahamic meditation? It's waiting for that Lech Lecha moment. It's waiting and listening to your thoughts until you hear the inner voice. That's the true voice calling you to go towards yourself.
So I had a very powerful prayer experience when I was at our headquarters. And what's wonderful about that, and also ironic about the fact that we, as irrational as we are, have made the headquarters of our global media network in a place that doesn't even have phone reception. But it really, really disconnected, and I felt, but that disconnection was so wonderful. And I was looking at these mountains when I sat down to talk to Hashem. I looked up, I was like, oh my goodness. And my prayer was like, please give me the eyes to see the majesty of this place, because even though I saw it through my eyes, I also had this awareness simultaneously that I wasn't even seeing the extent of it, that I wasn't seeing how incredible and beautiful it really is. Why? And you know, this is, I want to touch on this because it's also in this week's Torah portion in Re'eh. It says, when we come back into the land to possess it, we should destroy the sites of the other nations where they worship their gods, whether on mountains or on hills or their trees, and we should tear down their altars and smash their pillars. And, you know, I think a lot of Jews, when they read that, it just like summons up this image of ISIS and destroying everything that is everybody else's faith and not respecting other people's faith. So first of all, that is not a commandment for Jews. Whether or not it's even a commandment in our times right now is not what I'm commenting on, because I don't know how we're supposed to necessarily proceed at this moment in time. But what I do know is that that's not something we're supposed to or entrusted with or tasked with doing around the world. But it's in the land of Israel, it's specifically in the land of Israel that we're supposed to do that. Because the land of Israel, Jerusalem, isn't just a city. When we yearn for Jerusalem, it's a relationship we're yearning for. And that is the unity of the entire world. The truth of that unity emanates from Jerusalem. And these places of idolatry are the antithesis of that unity. It's multiplicity. It's duality. That is so contrary to the power of the message of the unity of all of existence that is supposed to come from Jerusalem. And that's why, you know, King David, when he's in chapter 132, it's so beautiful. I don't know if you remember this chapter 132. It says, David HaMelech, King David says, I will not enter my house, nor will I go into my bed. I will not give sleep to my eyes or slumber to my eyelids until I find a place for the Lord, an abode for the Mighty One of Jacob. There's such a yearning, but it's not, like he says, it's for a house for Hashem, a place from which that unity will permeate all of existence. And that's what we're really yearning for. That's what this whole thing is about.
You know, I think that in the times that you spoke about, sometimes you have an idea that comes to you and it brings a certain amount of serenity. And if it's bringing you serenity, you said intuitively, that just might be from God. And I think that in the times ahead, we are going to live through tumultuous times. There are going to be giant historic shifts in the world. We're going to live through a true roller coaster reality. It's just moments away, and anyone that doesn't see it must be blind. And I think that true peace of mind, Hashem's name is Shalom, is peace. His presence is peace. And when you're living intuitively in Hashem's will, and you know that, like, before you make life decisions, you're asking Hashem, listen, guide me in my life. I want to be guided by you. I want to be with you. There's peace there. There's serenity there. And that serenity is the koch, is the strength that all of us are going to need as we march ahead towards these incredible days ahead of us.
That's right. And the incredible days ahead of us, Elul. That's we're approaching the new month of Elul, which stands for Ani LeDodi VeDodi Li. This is a time where I say we bless all of our listeners around the world with being able to go out and meet the King in the fields, really cultivate our intuition, pray to Hashem for clarity, and listen back to what he has to say, and then see. We should all have the eyes to see. What did Rav Shlomo call them? Mashiach eyes. We should have eyes to see how everything that's happening in these days ahead, this is all bringing about something truly great. Ari Abramowitz here, Jeremy Gimpel. Reach out to us at any time. We love receiving your emails. Ari@thelandofisrael.com, Jeremy@thelandofisrael.com. Rate us on iTunes and reach out if you want to bring me. I'm coming to America soon in November. I think there's a few spots left open on this tour. Jeremy's going to be coming in the future also. Reach out if you want to bring us to your communities. And also, when you come here, we'd love to meet you here. Shalom, shalom. The objective of Mizrahi is the total revival of our nation in all its aspects. To revive the land for the nation, to revive Judaism in our hearts, and to revive our hearts for Judaism. The Land of Israel Network brought to you by Mizrahi Olami. That's the Mizrahi World Movement.
When I was growing up, I would read the books in the second half of the Old Testament, and sometimes I would get a little bit lost in all those prophecies of Jeremiah, Isaiah, and so on. That all changed the day I stepped foot in the Land of Israel. As I harvested grapes and olives and more on the mountains of Samaria, the words of the prophets came to life right before my very eyes. Today, you could be a part of this phenomenon too. I am Caleb Waller, and I'm inviting you to step into the pages of prophecy by joining us in Israel. Go to our website, that is hayovel.com, H-A-Y-O-V-E-L.com, to connect to this amazing opportunity.